A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. We are here today with an incredible Talkout episode that we recorded pre-COVID-19 when I was still in New York doing a play. Rob flew over and we had this amazing artist come talk to us, but we held on to the episode because it was to coincide with a show that is currently postponed at the Barbican Museum, the Curve space there. But we're going to talk to the artist today because in the interim, during lockdown, some exciting things have been happening, and yeah, we'd like to talk to Toyin Oji Odetola.
Hi, Toyin.
Hello.
Hi. Hi.
Where do we find you, Toyin?
Catch up.
Yes.
You find me in my Brooklyn apartment, right next to a windows, and it's a very particularly busy Sunday, strangely enough. A lot of people about. So if you hear some things in the background, that's what's happening.
Well, there's crazy stuff happening in Brooklyn. Well, all over the world right now. Like, I've been in Trafalgar Square today for protests, and that's all happening in New York and Brooklyn especially. There's been quite a lot of action.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've been very much staying at home throughout all of this, and including the recent developments with the protests. It's a really tough time, you know? Not just, you know, obviously in Minneapolis, but around the country, and a lot of people have just reached their boiling point, understandably so. And it's just like a moment of just like, we have been dealing with how society values us, not only pre-COVID-19 lockdown, but during the lockdown. I mean, as you guys may or may not already know, it's disproportionately affects minority communities, particularly African Americans, indigenous people, Latinx people, and also people of the LGBTQ+ community. And it just hasn't been addressed. And then just this past week, as again, you may or may not know, there's been just a string of horrific events that have happened to just sort of heighten that reality and make it known to the world through the documentation of, you know, so many things that have happened. For instance, the Central Park incident, and most recently with George Floyd. And I mean, I, as an artist, I've always felt like I have to, especially with regards to African-American issues in particular, I've always felt that I should be involved and educate myself, but also I'm very aware that people's voices who are most affected by this should be heard. You know, I don't want to speak over the people who are really truly affected by this issue daily. You know, I'm a Nigerian American. I came here as a young kid. And so essentially I did grow up, you know, again, as a Black person in America, but I also am coming from a place where I'm always willing to learn. I'm always willing to be quiet and let someone else speak, and to also support them and to give voice and whatever platform I have to engage with people who may not know about this reality and to educate them as well. But there comes a point, at least for me this week, and I sense it with a lot of my friends who are in a similar situation, that there's just a lot of exhaustion and a lot of anger and numbness, really. And it just boils down to just, again, the current situation with COVID-19, and then also just the fact that, you know, a lot of people feel powerless and again, just very angry. And I understand why people are going to the streets, you know, not just in the US, but around the world, saying this is enough is enough, you know, no justice, no peace. And, you know, with all of the responses that people have had and the sort of criticisms that people have had to protest, which, to be frank, has not been new. I mean, protest isn't meant to be nice. I mean, it's very funny when people have a lot of, you know, how do I even put this? Like, they tend to say, like, oh, how dare they loot this or, you know, burn this building. It's like, you have to understand these people are constantly being looted by their lives. They've been attacked by their lives. And so the looting of a building, the burning of a building is nothing in comparison to entire communities that have been affected daily by society, where they feel that they, not just they feel, they know that they are not seen as human beings, and their humanity has been constantly with, you know, not to be graphic, but it's just like that, you know, a knee to a neck. That is the life. That is the life of a lot of minorities in this country. And if you don't know, if you're uncomfortable, you're going to know, you know, and that's just how everyone's feeling right now.
Yeah, God. Yeah,
I think it's a time for everyone to really read
educate
as much as
themselves.
They can and educate themselves. Just, we've all been doing that ourselves. Like, all I've done for the whole, you know, last week basically is just read. Because, you know, we have to understand. And I thought I already knew quite a lot, but I've learned loads in the last week, you know?
Mm.
And I think we have to inspire other people to do that too.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like I said, I also am learning. I mean, that's the thing. It's like everyone thinks that there's no way to engage. You know, some people think, well, oh, you know, I'm just, for instance, someone might say, oh, I'm just a white person, I can't engage. And you're like, no, you can, by educating fellow, you know, people in your community who may not understand, and take a lot of that weight of explaining our humanity from Black folks to white folks. You can be that bridge for those people. We don't have to constantly have to explain. You can do that, you know, and do it in a language that, you know, your people can understand. You know, like, it's tough enough that I have to, or just so many of us have to say, I'm a human being. Do you understand that? Like, I'm a person. And just have that fall on deaf ears, you know, not just with, you know, with our current present zeitgeist, but generationally, you know, like, it's, this is something that's been going on, not just in this country, but around the globe. You know, people are just not understanding and not listening. One of my friends said something to me a few months ago that I always keep close to my heart, where she said, love isn't about saying I love you all the time. It's about saying I understand you. And I think that's what people really need to do. They need to learn to understand and stop trying to get defensive, start trying to make it about an individual issue. This is a systemic issue, and it affects people disproportionately. And you need to understand that. You know, that's the key.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, when we spoke to you before, which was before COVID, we were talking about a show which I said in the intro was is currently hung and ready to be seen at the Barbican Curve Space here in London. So the interview everyone's about to hear is about your process and building up to that. So how are you dealing with the knowledge now that that show is there and nobody's able to see it? And what have you done in the interim?
I mean, as you know, when prior to lockdown, I was incredibly excited to unveil this series, which is comprised of 40 new drawings made specifically for the Curve Commission, which was my very first solo exhibition in the UK. And, you know, I just was just really excited to see another side of my process and the way that I, you know, kind of work. And since then, of course, it's been on hold. And I just, you know, it's there. It's like I've kind of made my peace with it. I had a moment, but then now I'm like, it's there. You know, when the time will come, when everything's safe and people can, you know, engage with that work, I'm looking forward to that. I'm very excited about that. But
do
in the meantime...
has anyone said anything about, like, when they think that would be or when people will be able to, like, see the work?
It's kind of up in the air because, obviously, there's a lot of government intervention that is kind of in between this. So it's kind of beyond our hands, right? We have to wait until the UK government deems it okay, essentially, to reopen a lot of these cultural institutions in a way that is, again, safe for the public to go out and to engage. Until then, we really don't know. I mean, right now, our projections are either the summer or the fall of this year. And so, like I wish I could give people a definite answer, but it's really, like I said, it's predicated on things that are beyond our control. And obviously, safety is of the utmost importance. And when that is established and when that is made known to not just us, but everyone, then we can start making, you know, the proper moves to open up again. But it's really strange. I mean, it's there's a moment where I feel like the world needs culture right now. They need it so desperately. But then there's also a part of me that's like, maybe we do need a pause and we need to sort of read the room and understand that people are dying and this is still going on. There's no sign of a vaccine. And even if there were, there's going to be a lot of things in place when that vaccine does become known and is available to people and how it's available to people. So, you know, for me, I'm sure there's like, I'm human being, I'm frustrated, but also I'm trying to just keep my perspective with everything and just try to be as positive as I can and get too caught up in it. Yeah.
And one of the things you've done during lockdown is actually to make smaller works. Is that correct?
Yes. It was basically my way of dealing. I've always been someone who, in order to draw, I draw in order to understand. That's always been my thing. And so this past, I guess now it's been 3 months, I've just been drawing these small little stories. I call them stories because, you know, that's what they were. And they all kind of came out of nowhere. It was just, I don't know how else to describe them other than these random things that I needed to draw to kind of have my mind preoccupied with something that wasn't death. And also, to understand this situation in my own way. And from then it just sort of became this show now, a series that I've titled Tell Me a Story, I Don't Care If It's True. And it's a series of now, I think it's 22 works. Mm-hmm. I'm really nervous about it. But on the one hand, I feel that it needs to be shown because it represents what I hope to be what I'm hearing a lot of people are feeling, a lot of people, at least in the US, are feeling. And just being an artist of color in this time, you know, during this epidemic, this is sort of my way of saying or contributing to a larger narrative that everyone is sort of dealing with right now. So, yeah, that's kind of how it all came about. I mean, I always draw, like I said, to understand, but this is my way of understanding this time now. Yeah.
And this is a show for everyone because this is going online, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's an online exhibition with Jack Shaman, and it's going live this following week. So it's really exciting, really.
And
yeah,
people can access
really
that
excited.
Through the Jack Shaman Gallery website or?
Mm-hmm. It'll be available through the website. And it's all there, and you can see detail shots and you'll see the work as it is framed. And then, of course, details of the text that I wrote alongside the images that I drew. This is something that's relatively new to me as well. I'm very nervous about showing my writing to people. But it felt like that was what was needed for me, at least. To have the text and the image be in tandem and to create a narrative from that. Some of the images.
And this will be online from Tuesday, is that right? The 2nd of June?
Yeah, right now the projection is Tuesday. We had originally planned for Monday, but as you know, with everything is kind of, you know, with the internet and access, you know, we have to make sure everything is just right. So right now it's set for Tuesday for sure.
Great. Thank and you're you working so alongside a charity with this, right, for the show?
Yes. One of the things that I was so excited about was that the proceeds, 10% of the gross of the sales from this online exhibition will go to two organizations that I'm really, really glad that we're able to work with and I've been huge admirers of and supporters of, which is the Moms for Housing, which is located in the Bay Area in California. And you can look them up. They're an amazing organization that are just fighting a lot of the gentrification problems that are happening right now and how it's really affecting communities, entire communities that need help, that need housing. I mean, we talk about shelter in place right now. I mean, what happens when you don't have a home? And that's a real issue right now. And so that was something I really wanted to support. And then the other one is sort of an umbrella organization or collective through the Navajo Relief Fund, Navajo Nation Relief Fund, which is specifically supporting indigenous communities that are affected by COVID-19 right now. A lot of people aren't discussing how this is affecting a lot of the reservations and a lot of the First Nations in the U.S. who are affected disproportionately by the virus and how they have little resources and access in a lot of these places. And any help we can, you know, to donate and to help in this relief fund was something that I really wanted to do as well. So we're splitting the sales between those two organizations and collectives.
Very generous, Toyin. Well, that's because you're a generous, lovely person.
Oh, thank you. I'm trying.
And also, I think it's really generous of you to share so quickly this new body of work, and I'm so excited to see it. And, you know, I really believe strongly that culture and art in this time can bring people hope and inspiration and strength and solidarity as well. And, you know, and also I want everyone in America to know that we're with them in the UK, because it's a really terrible time at the moment, and we are all one, really.
Yes. Toyin, do you want to introduce your episode of Talk Art?
I don't know how do I introduce it. I guess this was a wonderful discussion that the three of us had in January, I believe, of this year. It was a wonderful, beautiful moment, and I'm so glad to share it with you all. I hope you enjoy it. I had a beautiful time, and I hope you will too.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I am... living the dream, because I'm in New York, which is like one of my favourite places
with
to
me.
Be. Well, it's actually not because I'm with you. Oh. It's because today we have a very special guest whose work has had such a big impact on your world because you actually live with her work.
Yeah.
But also you got me so hooked on her work to the point where I was like looking at every image, following every Instagram post. I got completely crazily obsessed.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like you.
No, it's not like me, is it? And today I'm feeling, you know how I'm feeling? I'm feeling splendid. And expensive looking. In other words, sumptuous, which could be a way to describe our guests' paintings. Yes. Sorry, not paintings, artworks.
Yes.
I keep calling them paintings and I realise they're not paintings. No. That's what's so special about this work. And the artist we're meeting today works predominantly with pastels and charcoal and pencil, and always on paper.
Yes.
So even though you might look at them
always on paper, but now onto linen.
Yeah, onto linen.
Which is a big change.
Big change. Sounds very sumptuous. So, and also that's the thing. It's almost like when you first see them, you might think, your brain thinks they're paintings.
Yeah.
So when I come to your house and I look at the one that's hanging on, you know, in that room, I'm like, oh, you've got a beautiful painting. But then the more you look at them, that's the special magic because it's not what you first think. Mm-hmm. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Toyin Oji Odutola.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
I'm so excited.
I've just got to start off and say that I am your biggest fan. I am so into your work. I was so incredibly moved by your work. I discovered your work at the Whitney. Do they call that the project room at the front? What is that room called?
I think it's emerging artists, kind of like exhibition space. It's like a specific space for emerging artists to show there.
Because it's the only room you don't have to pay. It's free. Right. I don't think people are aware of that, and people don't sometimes pass it by without realizing. But it's an incredible room that if you are passing by the Whitney, if you're not going to get in the line and go in the whole rest of the museum, you can go in this room at the front and see incredible shows. And that's where I saw your show, and I was there on the opening night, and I met your gallerist, Jack Shaneman, and it just changed something. It altered something in me and your work.
Wow.
And I think it's, well, we talk about it, but I think it's the narrative you set up, what you've established, and the fact that it's celebrating a gay partnership, fundamentally, and for me, connecting to that story, and then the estuaries that come off from love. Yeah. It's a love story, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
What your work is built on. And for me, I find it incredibly moving as a narrative, but just also your talent is exceptional.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so nervous, I have to say it. I'm shaking a little bit in my boots. But that is so sweet for you to say. That show really changed everything for my career. And I remember even when I was proposing it, it had shown in a museum in San Francisco, the Museum of African Diaspora. And I remember when they were asking me, like, what is this story about? I was like, well, it's two gay men that fell in love and thus their families came together. So the whole reason for this exhibition is because of their love. And I remember describing it to them and they were like, this is perfect for San Francisco. And I never would have thought it would extend the way it did to the Whitney, to...
So the show that was at the Whitney was the exact same show that was...
Oh, no, it was like the next chapter.
That's right.
Exactly. So, but when I started it, I really was not thinking it was going to become what it became because it ended up being... four exhibitions in total over the span of about 3 years. And so it was really intense, but I learned so much about storytelling through it, and I learned so much about how to create an experience for the viewer coming into a space. And so the wall paint was a part of it. Yeah. The way that the works kind of were installed and how you meandered through it was like meandering through the pages of a book or something. And I always wanted to be at the heart of it, that their love is the reason we're here. Like, you can't just go into it thinking they're just an anecdote in this larger tale. Like, we wouldn't see these two families at all if these two men hadn't decided to come together.
And Russell actually took me to the exhibition in New York when it just after it had opened. I think he was here a bit before and he went to the opening.
I think I went in about seven times.
Yeah. Oh,
really?
He took loads of friends. I know.
Loads
I remember
of
all our friends went to see
so
it.
Great.
And even people that weren't necessarily even into art, he would take them. Like, he was trying to take everybody to see your show. And we had actually met you at a dinner.
Right.
I think in about 2016,
oh,
maybe.
Oh, gosh. When, what?
And
yeah,
it was like Stanley Whitney, Marina Adams...
Lynette was there. That was the reason I was there.
Yeah. Lynette, Yadon Boachi, and it was at our friend Laurie's house and in London.
No, it was at a restaurant. It was Jimmy.
No, it wasn't.
No, it was at her house.
You always say that, and you're wrong.
Because I think you came a little bit later.
Oh, I came to that bit, and I wasn't at the house then.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, you were at the house. We didn't go to a restaurant.
I was going to say, I thought it was at someone's house.
It was at Laurie's house in West London. And your memory of it is
yes,
related.
But there was another... Maybe there was something after that. We went to another meal somewhere.
No, oh, y'all were just, like, hopping around.
No, that isn't what happened. I think you turned up late, so I don't know.
Okay, it's confusing. Anyway,
I'll cut that bit out, because who cares? Anyway, so we met in a social situation with other great artists.
Exactly.
And I didn't know anything about your work at the time, and you seemed quite, like, not shy, but
ratchet.
You were like... exactly, that was the word.
Ratchet.
I love that. No, but you seem quite like shy, and because there were people like Stanley Whitney there, who's obviously a great of contemporary art, and like has been making work for like decades and decades and decades, and has really stuck to his vision. I feel like you were like a younger artist, like a new voice, and you were kind of very respectful to these older artists who were there, kind of thing. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I just remember feeling from you this real genuine sort of. I just had a vibe about you that you were going to do something very special.
Oh.
And then suddenly, a year later, it all just started to... It's been one of the fastest kind of ascents.
I mean, people always say that, I think.
Yeah.
But then it's been like almost 10 years working.
Yeah.
But then it was like that. Like, I think when I was in London, when I met you guys, I don't think anyone knew who I was, which is great, because I think I had a little bit of freedom in the studio to kind of play and to test things. I wouldn't have done the story if I didn't feel I had the freedom to. Now I don't know if I would have made that show, just because the pressure is a bit intense. But at the time, it was so freeing, and I felt like I've seen all of these artists who have tested so many things, and I want to contribute, you know? I don't want to be someone who's just regurgitating the same old, tired, formulaic work, especially since I'm a figurative artist. And so people like Lynette are such a huge influence for me, because I just see how much she pushes the medium and tries things and really wants the viewer to pay attention. And so it was so funny when I met you guys. I remember meeting you guys, and you said something about Hamilton, and I was like, how did you get tickets?
I went to it twice as well, yeah.
I was like, these folks are on another level. And I'm just being honored being in that space. I remember just feeling, and Lynette was so generous and took me to all of these amazing institutions, and I learned so much in that trip. And coming back to the States, I just thought, okay, there's a huge history of figurative work. There's a lot of people who have really engaged with the black figure in a way that personally I don't like, but is a part of the history. Mm. What can I do? What can I say that can contribute to that in a way that I think is positive, that helps people think and helps them feel as if not only that they're seen, but there's possibility in the Black figure. And so that was sort of the machinations in my head as I came back and I said, all right, I'm going to do it. And then that's when I started working on the project.
So you made it aspirational, was your kind of device. You wanted to make something that was aspiring.
Yeah, but you know, so much of what, and I don't want to discount other artists who deal with the Black figure, but there's a lot of this narrative of struggle. There's a lot of this narrative of pain, yeah. You know? And it's not that it's not there. It's not that it's not a huge, inextricable part of how we live and what we are, but I just don't want to do that. I want to show that there's potential in this that has nothing to do with the pain. And there's some who might argue that we are special because of the pain. We are special because of that history. And that's kind of what uniquely unites all of us across the diaspora. But the diaspora could also be a place of joy. You know, it could also be a place of banality. It could also be a place of so much more. And that's what I wanted to do. I think that was key.
So, well, that's the love in it then. That's why you kind of rooted it around this love story.
Yeah.
So, and why did you decide to base it on two gay men then?
Look, being Nigerian, one of the things that was really heartbreaking was around, I think, 2004, 2003, the Nigerian government decided to enact a law that made it illegal to marry in Nigeria, for homosexuality to be legally married in Nigeria. And it was around the time when we were having this conversation in the U.S. It was so strange. Like, I remember the joke I told my mother is like, we can't have reliable lighting in certain parts and people have generators. But yes, let's pass a law that says that, you know, gay people can't. It was so strange. And there's still a lot of pushback, but there's such a huge gay population in Nigeria that's celebrated and there's a history of it. And so it was a fear mongering. It was a reaction to what I believe was a mood that was happening in the world, that people were like, come on, this is ridiculous. People should have a right to do what they want and to love who they love. This is not rocket science, but it's still contentious in the country. And around the time I was writing this, I thought about these men already, and I knew they were going to be Nigerian, because I'm Nigerian, so that's, you know. And I remember telling my mom this story, and she said, this is very powerful. Like, a lot of people like this. You know, a lot of Nigerians might not like this. And I said, that's not the point. That doesn't mean they don't exist. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, like, far-flinging into my imaginary to bring these two into being. They exist in Nigeria. This love exists. And everything else just kind of built around that. But that love was this is gonna sound cheesy as hell, but I was like, it carried me through. It helped me out because there were times in the story that was hard to draw certain scenes, but I kept thinking about them and thinking, this is important. You know, this story is so important. And I remember hearing
you
stories.
You wanted to tell their story.
Yeah.
And you'd imagined them, but they became a reality for
you. Yeah. And it was so funny because a lot of the guards would be like, you know, the kids that come in, they're like, that's my dad's, you know, like during the Whitney show. And, like, that's like, those are my dad's.
Oh, that
and,
makes me really,
you know,
emotional.
And like, it was so great.
You did
and,
that.
Yeah.
So has there been a backlash with people, certain people in Nigeria?
It's been mixed. I think some, the most of the Nigerians who have seen the show, like in the Whitney and things like that, are just like, that's not real. You know, they dismiss it. And that's their choice. You know, I'm not here to invalidate someone's experience of my work. That's not what I do. But the majority of the people who have seen the work, whether from Nigeria or where else, they loved it. They loved the story. They connected to these characters. Mm. And it was important, you know?
I find it really fascinating, this kind of ongoing saga, which has now come, has it come to an end now?
Yeah, it's done. Yeah.
So there was four chapters.
There was four exhibitions, but it was three chapters, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I found it really interesting, the idea of using it as a creative tool almost. So beyond all of what you've been speaking about, the kind of history and the politics and the emotion and all of those things, but using it almost as a way to like spark off productivity or creativity. Because I think sometimes if you're an artist and you can set rules, that the limit of that can actually end up being incredibly like infinite, like an expansive kind of.
Exactly.
Is that what happened for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I learned so much in the sense of what the potential of narrative can do in an exhibition. One of the reasons why I was so excited to do this project in the first place was all of my work was somehow alluding to me. Like, it was by de facto autobiographical, right, which made no sense to me at all. They're characters, you know, I'm not drawing myself. That would be really strange if, like, all I did was... And there are artists who do that. There are artists who are very much in that sort of practice, but I'm not interested in myself in that way. I'm interested in telling stories, and I didn't know that at the time. So after doing this project, I was like, I really like telling stories. I love this idea of like getting lost in a world. And yeah, so they were a world I was in for 3 years.
You sometimes cast your friends as roles.
Yeah.
So like Lynette's in there and Joanna, yeah, who works for the gallery, exactly, with you. And then they play like the Marchioness. Is it?
Yeah, Lynette. Oh, no, not Lynette. Lynette was one of the, I think, the sisters of one, right, of the lovers in the story. And then Joanna was the mother, of course.
Yes.
The executive Joanna is, yeah, amazing. Yeah,
yeah. So they, and you gave them roles. You gave, yeah, them like performances.
Because they
like
inspire, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you ever thought of writing the book of this? Or?
I'm so insecure about my writing.
Are you?
Everyone keeps talking about, because I do write these stories before I draw them.
Oh, you
them.
Do?
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I was going to ask, because, yeah, there's something so literary,
yeah,
about the way you kind of look at the world somehow. Yeah. Because one of the things, after we met you at that dinner, I followed you on Instagram at the time, mm-hmm, and I then deleted it a while after, but one of the things I remembered was how your approach to Instagram and posting, you used to write a lot of kind of comments, and,
yeah,
it felt incredibly generous and incredibly open, but also it felt like you were trying to like help people get inspiration or realize that the artist is actually a person, and,
yeah,
but in a very interesting way. And I felt like even the way you communicated on Instagram was kind of literary.
It's
somehow
strange, because I think now the medium isn't really, it doesn't give you room for that. This is around 2016, so we're still hopeful. And then, you know, now people don't even read captions that are like a sentence long, which is unfortunate. But I love stories, and I love this idea of text. You know, Baldessari just passed away, and he was all about how text and image are both suspect. And I love playing with text in that way.
What do you mean by suspect?
There's an interview, and I might be paraphrasing it, but he said something along the lines of how he did this series called Scenes and Scripts. And right. So it was an image, like some, like this corner of a book.
Yeah.
And then it would be like a scene from a movie or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And it was about this unreliability of the image and the unreliability of text, but how both of them create a story.
Uh-huh.
And I was always been fascinated with that. So I create text in that same manner. Like, I write the story out, but the image and the text are almost competing with each other. So what I create and what you see, the text is behind that.
So is it like, but, a snapshot of that story?
Yeah.
It's like a family,
it's a very
photo,
episodic,
and that day,
yeah,
we did this.
It's exactly. Like, it's episodic, but it's, yeah, it's layered too.
And you keep hold of them. You don't like...
Right. And it's this idea how the image can... Lynette said it best. I think it's like an image can only do so much that it... because a text can't do that. But you only write text because an image is insufficient. You know, it's vice versa. And yes, so that's how I use text in my work. That's why I feel very uncomfortable about sharing it, because it has a utility that's very specific to me and my process. And I love to communicate in that way, but it's not something that's like, oh, look, I can also do this. You know, yeah. It's more of like, it's very personal to me, I think, if that makes sense.
So this next body of work where you're, because you've been working on paper predominantly.
Yeah.
You're now moved on to linen. So they've started appearing in the last year. I think, yeah, they were at Frieze, I saw them.
Yeah.
So do you write stories for this next chapter in your career?
Yeah.
So where are we at to now then?
It's a whole nother... I mean, if I could give a summary, it's like Octavia Butler meets ancient Yoruba mythology meets geology and geological sciences and archaeology.
So there is some sci-fi in there, right?
It's a lot of sci-fi.
Because I know you're a big fan of Star Trek.
I love
so. So I think that's amazing. We've now got a bit of Star Trek into Tween's work. Brilliant.
I've always been a huge... I mean, I have Octavia Butler's signature tattooed on my hand.
No way! That's
yeah,
so cool.
That's her signature. I'm a huge sci-fi nerd, and I've always wanted to do sci-fi, but again, it's like this thing where people think, okay, she does these really luscious looking figures, you know, after my last series.
With a lot of color. Yeah.
Right, and like, you know, everyone looks very glamorous, and I was like, well, that was just a chat, you know, that was just a story, you know, that's not all I do. And so I wanted to just show what else is possible, and linen kind of came into the fore. I said, I've never worked on that surface before, so let's try that. And I wanted to limit the palette after, you know, 3 years of just polychromatic exploration. And yeah, that restriction just opened up a world. Like, it's really crazy. In fact, I'm kind of scared, actually, because I think people are going to walk into the Barbican space and just be like, what happened in the last year?
But what's the response been like so far? People have seen it.
People are confused a bit, I think, because they're so used to a certain work that I do.
Yeah.
But it's also, they're very intrigued and they're very much want to be live in that world.
I mean, it's so refreshing. Yeah. Just even you talking about it. I love this idea that you've sort of pushed yourself to try something new, not even just the surface, but then take your work somewhere else.
Yeah.
That's quite a scary thing to do.
It's utterly terrifying.
Yeah. If you're really, really successful and popular,
yeah,
and then suddenly you go like, right, well, I'm stopping that now and I'm doing this.
Take a smooth left and just do something completely different.
It feels like a sharp left.
Does it feel like you had to really have a lot of guts to do that, or is that just your personality?
You know what?
Are you brave?
Like, I'm not brave. I think I was just talking to my friend about this. It's a daily struggle because you have to convince yourself to look at the work macrocosmically. I think with artists, we get so caught up in it. You know, we're in the world and we're in it, and we're scared because we don't know how people are going to respond to it because we're so entrenched. And I had to kind of train myself to realize that what you are doing, you can't know it now, like you never will. You can just do it. And you feel a deep foundational urge to make this work. It's coming from a place that's important, obviously, because you can't ignore it. And so you give it all you can in this time you're allowed. And whatever happens, happens. If you fail, okay, but you gave it your shot. And what people are, I think a lot of my friends who have seen the work, they feel a very emotional connection to the work. It's very deeply like, yeah, this one of my friends was like damn near tears. She was like, girl, this is like some deep shit, like about Africa and about, and I didn't think it was going to be that, but it's just become that.
And you've currently, so how many works are going to be in the show? Did you say 7?
40.
Oh, 40?
Yeah.
No way. 40 works of all different scales.
Yeah, mostly 7 feet. Some of them are diptychs. Some of them are triptychs. But yeah, it's just me making 40 pieces.
So it's a major show then.
Yeah.
Wow. You're super loved for the way you create skin, black skin, and the way that it has kind of like light reflections in it. These newer works, you've completely changed that style of how you paint or you draw black skin.
Yeah. But it's also this idea of like, what is blackness and what does that entail? What does that contain? And also I wanted to, again, going into sci-fi, what is blackness in that context? Because I think oftentimes the black skin reads differently in sci-fi stories. That's why I love Octavia Butler so much. You forget these are black characters. Not that it isn't important, it's just fact. And then you move on. And so the features of these characters is African, but that's not the end point. And I think whenever people see my skin and, you know, I still go into it and I make it luscious, I give it a sort of tactility, but I felt that people were distracted by the blackness as an endpoint, not as a journey. And one of the things that I always see is black skin is that it's a catalyst for stories. You know, it's a fact to start from, and then we move on. But the problem with reads is that people look at blackness and they think that's the end of the sentence. That's the point. And it's like, no, I don't wake up and just think I'm black, therefore that's it. Like, that's not a way to live. And pictures shouldn't be read in that finite way either. And so one of the reasons why I also wanted to be monochromatic in this whole series was you forget the blackness and you actually pay attention to what's going on and you're seeing the story unfold. Wow. So it's not an anti-black sort of like, oh, you know, there's very polemical statements that have been made about like, well, I don't really see blackness, and that's not what I'm doing. It's entrenched in the work. Mm. It's everywhere, but it's not something that distracts you to the point where you don't see anything else but that blackness.
That's
that
so
makes sense.
So it really is like the next step, isn't it? It's like so it's still in a way linked to, even though it's not narratively linked to the previous saga, which I love calling it the saga.
It is.
It sounds so kind of romantic and like old times or something. I don't know. I love it. But
it feels like a Mills and Boone sort of book. It's kind of like this.
Mills and Boone.
It's what
makes
you think of these snapshots that like you see the covers of Mills and Boone. It's like,
I think like Zadie Smith, who was an amazing writer, was saying like it's Edith Wharton or something. I was like, whoa, this is some intense. Like, I don't know if I'm that into it, but they're literary, the work, and it all came from that last series. I was not doing work like that before, so this
new work, do you think that had been there the whole time and you'd been denying it because you had to do this other body of work, or do you
I think my mom is such a she's so like on it. Like when I started showing her the very first pieces, she was like, this has been in you since you were like 18. I could tell.
Seriously?
Like she knew. And I was like, you know,
it's, the DNA.
It's, right.
Like, within you.
It's
yeah.
always been there. And it's nice to finally, oh God, it's so weird. I've had friends finally come to the studio to see the work, and the responses have been so interesting, especially ones who have known me for a really long time. And they're like, this has been in you for years. This is before the last year. This is something that you've needed to get out of you for a while. And now that it's out, it feels like I'm free to do anything.
Like, so do you feel like this is, again, one body of work, and now you're going to go
and
like,
then I'm already on the next.
And...
Yeah, I'm already on the next project.
No way.
So
do you think that the fact you had the kind of critical and kind of commercial success and respect, because people have taken you very seriously because you are incredibly skilled as a kind of draftsperson and an artist and a painter, you know, a figurative artist, and because the thoughts behind it are so rigorous and so intelligent and, you know, profound. But do you think that that kind of critical reception has then led to you feeling confident enough to do what you just done?
Sometimes people just need to know that they're allowed. You know, you go through like stages where you believe in yourself that, yeah, my work is strong. I have the potential. I know this to be true because I feel it in my bones, but it's not in the context of how you live. And in the art world, everything's very monetary and everything is very much about who just gives you that like ting, like, oh, she's good. And they pull you from the, you know, the sea of people who are all talented, who are all amazing, but you've been picked. It gives you so much of a release. It's like suddenly I am allowed to do whatever I want now, because so much of what you do, or at least for me, was like, I have to prove that I have a reason to be here. I have to justify why my work is on the walls. I have to work like a crazy person to the point where my mother's calling me like, girl, I am really worried for your health.
Really?
But you know,
yeah.
Like, you know, it's like this idea that earn your keep, earn the reason you were picked. And to me, that's rigor. To me, that's like really demanding the best of yourself. But then after a while, it comes to a head and you realize, okay, who am I really proving this for? You know, I've been very fortunate to have the critical and commercial success that really was unexpected from the last series.
Sure. Yeah.
And I really was very fine with where I was before that. But suddenly it elevated my work into a space that made me very uncomfortable. And a lot of the stuff in that saga was pressured by that. And there were some dark times. I felt really scared about failure. And one of this series was so important to me because it was, this is going to sound real emotional, and I apologize.
No, please.
But I remember when I did the last series, I kept in an interview, I said, it's like, it's for that 14-year-old Toyin who was like really like an Anglophile and like loved, you know, like stories about all this sort of thing. And then now this series that I just am finishing is for like 19-year-old Toyin, and this who was in college and read Octavia Butler, like, you know, Octavia E. Butler for like days and was really into Star Trek and all this stuff.
You're like
and,
Adele. Every two years she releases an album. So you're an Anglophile. So for you, the Barbican is like the
dream.
Oh
my God, it's I'm losing my shit. Sorry, can I?
Of course.
Yeah,
we're saying you're losing your
and
shit.
And also, don't ever apologize for emotion because we love emotional talk.
But yeah, it's like that. It's like I'm just thinking about that girl who was really depressed and really didn't think she would ever have a space to show her work and would ever be given a platform in any way. And to be where I am, to have even young people say, you inspire me, like that really hits me in a very emotional place. And I wanna give that to them. You know, that's where I'm at now. Like after all that success has brought me, it's like, look, I was there with you. Like I thought I didn't matter at all. Like I didn't think what I created meant anything. Mm. And now I'm here. The least I can show is that this ratchet girl from Alabama is showing at the Barbican. That's crazy. Like, you know, that's really insane. But also that this ratchet girl from Alabama is going to show you the best that she's got.
Yeah.
Like the best work. And not take the viewer for granted in that.
Do you think about the viewer?
I do. A lot. I think because I hate this idea that people go into museums and they feel they can't connect to work, or it's somehow like, oh, I'm not smart enough for that, or I don't have.
That's what we're all about.
You know? Mm. And it's like, no, you have the tools. Viewership is an activity, but you have to believe that you are partaking in the art making when you see it. And I think a lot of, And it's not a fault of museums or anything like that. I think they're trying to establish that this is an important work, but in that they're alienating people. They feel like they can't connect. And what I love is when young kids, they don't have that yet. So they see the work and they're like, that dude dumped her. You know, and it's like, you know, some like mythology. They're, yeah. And then they had
like
this.
A soap opera.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, but it's like some ancient mythology or Renaissance painting, but they can totally connect.
Yeah.
And I want my work to be that for people. I want people to walk through it and say, oh, I totally know what that scene is about. Or like, oh, he's giving her the side eye. Like, yeah, like make it on your terms.
Project,
you know, bring
onto
it, to,
it and give it your
yeah,
own, yeah,
and make it yours. You know, art is yours. That's what made me want to be an artist. I saw something and I was like, that's mine. You know, even though I might not recognize myself in it, my story was projected onto it. I could see the potential there and I loved it for that.
Can you remember what the first things were you saw?
This is going to sound so cheesy. I remember it was Elizabeth Catlett and it was Barclay L. Hendrix, and it was John Singer Sargent. Those works blew my mind.
And where would you have seen those?
Oh, just usually, because I was in Alabama, it was like books or the internet. You know, I was kind of part of that generation that came up with that. So seeing them online, like seeing an Elizabeth Catlett like sculpture and going, this is insane. Like, you know, she had a sculpture named Ife, and I was like, I was born in Ife, what? You know, and like all of that stuff. And like Barclay L. Hendrix, like, come on. Like his stuff is just, he's the OG, man. Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
There's an amazing exhibition about to open. It'll be on when your show's on at the Barbican.
Oh.
But it's in the town where I live now, outside of London, called Margate.
Oh.
And it's a seaside town. Everyone listening knows about it already. Because I mention it a lot. But there's a museum there called the Turner Contemporary. They just had the Turner Prize there. And they are doing a show called We Will Walk. And it's opening beginning of February. And it goes on till June, I think.
Oh, wow.
And it's from Alabama. And it's all like yard art. And the incredible movement of like quilt making.
Yes.
And it's an extensive group exhibition.
And that's so amazing.
It's going to have a big impact, I think. But you should try and come down and see it.
I would love to see that. Yeah. Margate's so like famous now.
It's buzzing.
Yeah.
How attached do you get to your work? Like you saying you had a big commercial success, so most of your works have been placed now. Did you keep any back for yourself?
I try to, but it's harder because, you know, it's like I said, it's a monetary thing. You got to keep the lights on. You got to sell the work.
Yeah.
I remember someone said, "Oh, I can't afford your work." I was like, "Girl, I can't afford my work either. Who you think this is?" But it's, yeah, you know, but I try to keep as much as I can. And it's not really me keeping it. It's for my family. Mm. I have two younger brothers and I often think about them and their families. And I would love for them to live with my work if that's a gift I can provide. But yeah, I get very attached, but then there's a disassociation that happens when it's up. It's kind of like, you know, for lack of a better metaphor, they're my babies, but they have their own lives. Like, you know what I mean? Like they're out there in the world and they're free. But there are pieces that I make that I'm like, God, man, that's a special one.
And you miss it. No, it's gonna
be yours was like that.
Was it a special one? Oh good.
It was one.
Mine's called The Abstraction of a Continent.
Yeah,
and I bought that and it was going to SCAD, to Savannah, the Savannah College of Art and Design.
Mm.
I went there. I mean, I went to Savannah
Storm.
To see your work. And Storm, the curator
who's
there, was
amazing.
Storm, let me just get his name right. Storm
Jensen,
Storm Jensen Van Rensburg.
Yes.
And he walked me around. And
he's amazing.
The show is amazing, but that work that I have and I get to live with every day is just so powerful.
Yeah.
And beautiful, and you were attached to that one.
I really was. I mean, there's the pieces that really kind of struck me are the ones that have an emotional depth and gravity that I don't know. Sometimes it's not even readily visible to people, I think, but that one is.
And who is he in the mythology?
So he's actually one of the main characters. This is like kind of like during his college years, and he's having a bit of a crisis.
He's one of
the couple. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know. I thought he was a cousin.
He's
got the lead.
So there's like pieces throughout the saga where like I wanted to show like what it's like. I mean, to live with that decision that you have. Especially in Nigerian culture, your family name is so important.
Yes.
Your family's, you know, pride and history is so important. And grappling with being gay, grappling with anything that is, you are that queer element in your family story. And I think that what I wanted to show was that it's not something that should be treaded lightly. It's not something you tack on. And I think in our society now, people think it's something that, because it's now because of the hard work of a lot of people over many generations, people think it's so cool to be in that queer space. Nah, boo, it is hard. Mm. It is a difficult process and it is daily. Mm. And it's something that
someone has to affirm every day, I am who I am, and I love that. And I'm going out in the world, and I'm going to contribute in a way that is a loving space, you know? But to show that in a drawing is tricky because there's no text to tell you that's happening. And so the emotion has to be subtle enough but still hold you as a viewer to see it. And I think queerness is so freeing in that, is it shows.
Oh, Rocky, no.
Rocky agrees.
Yes.
Yeah, Rocky's like, here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's an ally.
Yeah. He's a total ally.
Shush, baby.
Talking about the importance of your family name, I remember when we first met, you said somebody had published an article about you, or even it might have been like a little thing or something, and they just put your name as Toyin Odetola.
Yeah.
And without your
OG.
Exactly, which is your mother's name. And then Odetola is your father's name. Mm. Can you talk a bit about the importance of having your mother's name and your father's name side by side? I love that story.
No, it's really something that I always say. I'm afraid that people get like, they don't understand why it's so important to me because in again, Nigerian culture, I'm part of the Yoruba and the Igbo tribe. So my father is Yoruba and my mother's Igbo. And if anyone knows anything about the Biafran War, right after the British
Civil
left,
War, right?
Those were the two main tribes that were fighting for power. And I don't know, I'm not going to say and pretend that I know the ins and outs of that war, but it was pretty...
Well, we said it was like West Side Story or Romeo and Juliet.
It's even deeper than that.
Dad was from one side of the Civil War and your mum was from the other.
Exactly. And even when they met, I mean, they're members of both of my parents' family who don't talk to my parents. I mean, it's still like it's still a thing. But I mean, now there's people my generation who do this all the time. You hear about weddings where, he happens to be from this tribe and it's not a thing. But at the time I was born, it was like, I think some members hadn't even met me until I was like four. Like, you know what I mean? Like they were just like, we're not engaging, you know, with this at all. And it's such a leap of faith that my parents did to say, I choose you. You know, like, I choose you despite all of this history, despite all of this, like...
And what you're going to go through.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, and that is, like, truly the power of love, isn't it?
Really?
And to, like, yeah. Like
and that's
say,
in
like,
your blueprint, then.
Exactly. That's, like, in my family.
Love is, like, that strong love that you need love.
Exactly. Yeah. But then, of course, you know, fast forward to 2020, and they're, like, fighting over the remote. And I'm like, y'all went through all of that to be fighting over the remote right now. Like, but it's true. Like, it's so inspiring to me. And also, my mother is such a huge influence on my life. And I want her name to be on the walls wherever I go, wherever I show my work. She's a part of my story.
Because originally it wasn't.
Yeah, because, you know, it's this idea of patriarchy. You know, your father's name is your name. And no, I am of two very strong, very proud tribes and two very strong, proud histories. And I want those to be with me wherever I go. And
that's
so,
really emotional. That's why I wanted to ask you. I know you have spoken about it a lot.
Yeah.
And it must get a bit, like, tedious to keep talking about the same thing. But the thing is, I just find it so deeply... Because it's the pride you have for both of your parents.
And like, they each have equal weight. There's no hyphen. They each have their equal own, importance.
And they stand next to each other. And, I mean, of course, there's some Yorubas out there. I'm going to say what I'm going to say. I'm going to be petty for a second. But some Yorubas on Instagram be like, we ain't going to put the OG. And they put the Odutola, and they know damn well.
Because on your Instagram handle, it says it's... OG Odutola,
exactly.
Yeah.
But then I'll have like some, like, especially Nigerian media, they'll be like, Ms. Odutola. I said, okay. I see what you did there.
So going back to family and like childhood, what were you like? How did it begin? Like the creativity for you? Like, where did it come from?
I was not an artistic kid. I was very rambunctious. And like, my parents were worried about me. They probably thought I was going to go to jail.
Really?
I was pretty, like, I was a bit of a rebel in the sense that like, And I think about it now, looking back, I was just someone who, one, I never had a good relationship with authority. But I also, like, one of the things that art has really gifted me is, like, if you choose a position, you better prove why you choose that position. Art is something that is like, okay, I have this idea. Okay, test it out. Prove it. And that's what I feel about people. And so whenever someone would tell me something that was just like a blanket statement, or they just say, oh, this is what it is, I said, wait. Prove it. Why? Don't just say, I believe this thing. Why do you believe this thing? Or don't just say, like, this is the way things are. But why? You know, that was it. And so I got into trouble a lot with teachers, with authority figures and things like that. But it came off as just me being like a brat. But it was really me trying to understand the world. And so my parents were really scared that I was going to just come up on a lot of people because I always look at both sides of things. Like, whenever someone makes a statement, regardless of their position, it's like, that's how I feel. I said, but then someone can make an equally valid statement from the other side of the table. You can't just say that, you know, and say it's truth and fact. Like, and one of the things that art really gifts me is that I am constantly thinking about two sides of everything while I'm working and how that can be read. And I always test, I always say I come out with a question whenever I make a series or a work. And if that question is not answered by the end of that work, I failed. That's, to me, a failure of the work. Wow. And so I was that way as a kid. I was always testing things out, trying things, because I just wanted to see, like, what does this mean? What is the definition? And not have it be something that's just, like, dismissive or just like that's the way it is. I could never accept that as a child, and so I got into a lot of trouble as a kid.
In a way, that sounds like you had a very sort of bright intellect. Like, you were obviously highly intelligent,
or I was just bratty.
Yeah, no, but it's almost like you had to, instead of taking the world for what it looks
granted,
like,
yeah.
you were like, but what is making that? You know, look like
yeah, you were challenging received wisdom.
Right. Yes.
And we're like, well, why are you saying that?
Even myself. Like, just the fact that I had a propensity to do certain things. Like, why do I always think this way? Or why do I always feel this way? Like, it wasn't just other people. It was myself, too.
So what about drawing for you?
That
must have been such a key part of everything that you've become. So when did you remember first starting to draw and what it meant
was,
to you?
It was the Lion King.
Lion King? Are you serious?
Yeah.
The animation.
Yeah. I love
like
animation.
Jaws on the floor right now. He's like the Lion King.
Wow,
like, we're going all over the place with this.
This is heaven.
I wanted to be an animator. I wanted to be an illustrator and an animator for many years. I love Japanese anime. I love Disney films, like, you know, Aladdin, The Lion King. I love those movies, and so I wanted to be an animator. And when my family we lived in California for a few years, and we had to move to Alabama. And my mom was really scared because I got really depressed because I was like, I don't want to move again. We've moved so much. And so she got me a Lion King, like, coloring book, like, you know. And she was like, have at it, you know. We're going to be traveling for a few days. Do that. And I copied Timon like a crazy person. Every, like, hotel, like, you know, pad or paper, anything I could find, I was drawn to Timon. And I never liked to draw before. It was just something that happened. And then Timon became my little avatar. And after a while, when we finally moved to Alabama, I was like, okay, I should probably draw something else. And that's when I started just taking art classes in school or starting art clubs in school. And then this whole idea of like, oh, wow, I'm looking at your face and I just transported it onto a surface. That's magic.
Wow, the
that's crazy. Yeah. And drawing became this like fascinating, magical thing that was mine, you know? So we could move wherever we want, but I had that. I could take that. I could look at your face. I could look at a book and I could transpose it on a surface, and it was mine. And so that became like, I think that was what it was. It was sort of a coping mechanism for me. But now it's become something else, you know, as I've grown. But
and moving around a lot really appears in your work constantly throughout. That really affects, especially the last subjects, the way they go.
Yeah. I've always said it, like, you know, it's a landscape, the surface of my work. Yeah, they're portraits of people, you know, in scenes or whatever, but it's a landscape your eye travels. I want the eye to dance. I want y'all to really like meander through the work, and because that's what I do when I make it. And so, yeah, that's drawing for me is the most magical thing. Like, I love it.
And you class yourself as a draftswoman.
I do.
Rather than a painter.
Yeah, I just don't know what to do with a brush.
But do you think that's next? Is that, can you see the future of you picking up a paintbrush?
I've tried. It's just.
I almost feel like though you're trying to be so much you, and you don't want to do something that other people have done. And in a way, I guess less people have sort of focused the whole of their, you know, the main part of their work being done like in that way.
Drawing
is kind of a unique thing for you, isn't it?
It's also like an immediate thing. You know, I think whenever people talk about drawing, it's the immediacy of the line, you know, like painting can be immediate. I'm not saying it can't, but drawing is by definition about immediacy. You know, the cartoon, the sketch, it's like I have this thing in my head and I got to get it down really quickly. And so there's that like energy in the work that I like, even though my stuff is very composed and layered and researched, it still has that element of immediacy.
So how many sketches do you normally make before you make a drawing?
Many thumbnail sketches. And I plan, sometimes I combine different ones, and the composition is very important to me. But when I start it, when the sketch is down, oh, it's on. Like, it's like almost as if everything's out the window, and then the drawing really happens, and everything is immediate. And it could be like the other day I was working on a drawing, and there was a face of a character that was one way, and then all of a sudden I was like, nah, I'm gonna make him angry, or something, and then there was another guy who kind of looked like, I don't even know what the equivalent would be. He was kind of like, all right, like that kind of like face. And so, yeah, that's what I love about drawing. It can change. It's mercurial, you know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Mercurial. That's a beautiful word.
Do they hinge on any the new show, The Barbican? Are they hinging like the past series did on the love story? What do they hinge on in the new story?
You know,
or is that too?
Speaking of the story, Zadie told me I should probably. This might be when I tell people the story. I might as well, because there's not going to be any text. But I will say this: it is a love story between a man and a woman. But it's not really. They're not men and women in how we think. They're like humanoid characters, but they come from worlds that are actually, or systems, I should say, where homosexuality and just homosexual relations are actually the norm. And it's the opposite of when a heterosexual couple comes together. It's actually aberrant. It's actually kind of forbidden.
Wow.
So it's like, it's the complete inverse. Ooh,
that's
so that's kind of the love story. That's the thing. It's like they're coming together. It's like, girl, what? Or dude, what?
In the last series, everyone around them was celebrating in that love story. Mm. And they were like, the audience were like family members at the wedding, for example.
Exactly.
Whereas this one, people are...
They're
against it.
Exactly. They're
so,
against
so the feeling throughout is a bit like resentment, or a bit like...
They're like almost... It's kind of like my parents' love. It's like, how could you? You know, like, how could
yeah,
you?
It's almost like hostility.
Wow.
Yeah. Kind of it breaks the whole system
and
down.
And all these kind of other energies.
Because the idea of partnership in this world is through a partner who is the same gender as you or the same sexual identity as you. It is not through a heterosexual sort of coupling. And so they're accidentally falling in love is... kind of like a big moment in the story.
And this is
how my brain works. Y'all brought me on here.
But if you think of a universe, that you created in that first saga, is this still the same universe, or is it like a new universe?
It's a completely different world.
Completely separate.
These are like sci-fi. It's a whole nother. The language, the rules in this world are completely different. They're alien in a sense.
So like completely different planets.
Exactly.
Different universes. Yeah.
I was just inspired by, and it really came out of nowhere. But there's in central Nigeria, which I've never been and I have no family in, there's these rock formations that are like millions of years old. I'm talking like basalt rock, black shale. They're like paleolithic, like that, like with pictographs on them. And I remember reading about this and going...
With what on them?
Pictographs, so like markings. So like ancient peoples, on like volcanic rock, like basalt, that had risen from the ground millennia, right?
Wow.
We can't even date these. I love how whenever people talk about Stonehenge, for instance, I'm like, there's Stonehenges in like Africa. You do realize.
Yeah.
And so there's this like, I remember my auntie even told me, she's a geologist. She's like, yeah, there's a lot of these rocks. And I thought, what if there was an ancient civilization?
Yeah.
Like, what would that look like? And like.
Well, like Atlantis.
Or something, right?
Something, yeah.
And just this whole thing. And the story just came from that. It was just like, I was given creative license to just imagine a civilization that is in central Nigeria and has this world. And it just came from reading about it.
Wow.
But that's part of the research, that's part of the story making element. And then everything just kind of comes together. And it really could be a conversation I heard someone say, that could be interesting. Or, you know, but like that was what was the crux of this story.
Yeah. So tell us about your studio practice. How often are you in there?
All the time.
All the time. How many works are you on at a time? How many can you work on?
I can work on multiple at a time. I think every work informs the other, so it's nice to have multiple up on the wall. But sometimes when you're in it with one piece, you know, you can't
focus
ignore it.
That.
Yeah.
Are you in the same studio you've been for a while?
I just moved. So I just moved to BK. I was in the city for a while, and now...
You was in Manhattan, was you?
Yeah, I was in the EFA.
Where's that?
It was like Garment District.
Okay.
Midtown. Right.
And it's a great space, but I needed like a bigger, especially with this new work, so I need a bigger space.
So did you make the whole of the Barbican show in that new space, not in between the two?
Mm-mm.
Oh, that's all great. So you had a complete focus.
It's like a whole shift, isn't it? An energy.
And right now, your shipment goes in 2 days' time to London.
Yeah.
So you've completed, 33 of the works?
35?
35 of the works.
Yeah.
So you've got a few left to go.
Yeah.
I can't believe you're speaking to us. I'm so grateful.
No, thank you. Awesome. It's dope. It's just, I mean, it's kind of insane that 40 pieces came out of this body, but child, you know, I knew I was going to do it. It's a massive space. And I knew that this is my first solo show in the UK ever. I wanted to give the UK something that, you know, it was just something that they could just say, yeah, you know, I want kids to see that and just be like, I said this to Lottie Johnson, who's a curator of my show. She's amazing. I said this to her. They were like, what do you want this show to be? And they were trying to do the programming text. I said, don't just say it's a black show. Don't do that to the people. And they're like, well, what do you want it? I said, if anything, I just want to show that y'all have options as a black artist. You don't have to do the same things. Mm. There's so many worlds you can, you know, explore and do. And if I can give them anything, if you want to write about this show, it's about we have options. So
you know what's really interesting as well is I think what I took away from the show that Russell took me to is the idea, and I was actually going to introduce the episode like that, but I changed my mind in the end, but about this idea of potential and the power of potential within all of us.
Mm.
And I know we have different like backgrounds, and I'm white skinned, and I don't have the same history. But I did take away something like a kind of idea that no matter what your background is, whether you've been grown up very poor, very rich, whatever, like you can make something of yourself, and it can be you can dream big, and those dreams can be realized, and it might be a really hard struggle, and it might take a long, long time, but like. There's something about your work that's like you can just see the decades of effort you've put in to like create something, and then it's gone transcendent. You know, it's gone to a place where it's actually just so beautiful now. Mm. It's and I was thinking weirdly about like ancient things, like I don't know, like Michelangelo or like I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but what I mean is like that sense of commitment to something.
Mm.
And I believe if you commit yourself to something and to what you really believe in your deepest like, you know, the things you only tell yourself, like in your heart, you can make that life a reality for yourself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And for me it's a different struggle because it's be like coming to terms with being gay, you know, in a community that was very, you know, conservative, whatever, and then having to just constantly believe in who you are.
Yeah.
And now that I'm 39, I'm just beginning to feel happy, and I'm beginning to feel like I found my calling, even doing this podcast with Russell.
Oh, wow.
And I get that from your work, though, and I take that for me, if you see what I mean.
So
it's not, I don't think it's like you're saying, it's not just a black show or it's kind of for everyone.
I mean, the systems that we live in are very powerful, and I'm not going to sit here and make people feel like I don't want to have people's individual things become the reason that the system is bad to you. No, the system is bad.
Right.
You as a person are not bad. You are not wrong. And I think part of the reason why with the way people talk about black art or anything that's marginalized is that it ascribes so much of that badness or abnormality in the system to who you are as a marginalized person. And that's bullshit. The system is bad. And your dreaming, your belief in yourself has nothing to do with the system, and you have a right to that dream.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get caught up in the system because they see it affirms that everything that they are is wrong, everything that they are isn't true, or whatever, and it's lies. The system just benefits from you feeling that way.
Right.
And if you, I'm not gonna sit here and say my work is gonna save lives. I know what my work does, but I think if art can do anything, is that it helps people get ideas.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? About how to tackle the system and not get caught up in their own individual like thing, because part of what, I mean, everyone who says they do political work now, of course work is political, because we live in a system that's very unfair, but what you need to understand is that art gives us that, again, that why. Why do we live this way? Why do we believe the things we believe? Why is the system like this? And then it gets you out of that individual space and into something grander. And it takes the load off of you. Like, it's not you. You know what I mean? You're not the problem.
Yeah.
You're just a part of a system that's wrong.
Yeah.
You know? So that's what I meant by, like, when they were talking about the language of the work. Don't just say black work, because that's the system there. Don't do that to people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. How long will you be in London then for the show?
I think I'm there for March for the install and everything.
And will you be curating it? Like, I mean, installing it?
Yeah.
Do you know where you want to place the work?
Oh, I got the whole thing.
Really?
I mean, my notebooks with all the writings, it's like all of the way that everything's supposed to go is in there too. So I'm bringing my little raggedy notebook with me. And yeah, I'm excited. It's going to be interesting. We're having a soundtrack by the sound artist Peter Ajayi doing. So it's like you're going to walk into the space and it's like you're going to hear his music.
It's immersive, right.
So it's going to be very immersive.
Is it quite sci-fi music? Or?
I mean, it's beautiful. I've been listening to his composition. It's amazing.
And he made it specifically for your show?
Yeah, specifically.
What's the title of your show?
A Countervailing Theory.
And what does that relate to?
But this idea to countervail something, by definition, is one force or one idea must have an equally opposing force to balance everything out. And it's this idea that, like, again, the why. If someone comes at you with this dominating point, this force, like, this is it, something has to come to balance it. It can't just be one thing. That's the world. That's everything. And in this story, there has been this idea of a system, lovers doing this or whatever, and these two people who aren't supposed to be together come together and countervail that entire system. And so it's a theory that I'm positing to the people. It can extend to a lot of things. It's a very pretentious sounding title, but it comes from a deeply emotional place.
Titles are so important to you. You title all your works.
I know, because it's interesting.
And you title your shows.
Yeah.
And they're always special. It's
But I also was interested in that exactly what Russ just said, because the titles you have decided to share with people. So that's a part of the text that you are revealing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so I was going to say, like, because To Wonder Determined.
Yeah.
Like, so, and like the new one, like, you, they're such specific, you know.
And Scad was testing the name, but now we spoke about your parents' names.
Yeah.
I think, is that relation to you testing your name with OG as well, or is it testing the name of...
I didn't think about it that way. No, Testing the Name was about that queerness narrative. It's like, I don't know if you remember when you saw the show, there was a letter.
Yeah.
So that letter is from
As you walked in. Yeah. Yes.
So that was a letter from the father to his son who's come out to him in the last letter, which we don't see. So this is the response to his come out letter.
Right, yeah.
And in that letter, he says, son, if you think that you being gay is wrong or that it's going to somehow test the name of this family, meaning it's going to ruin this family's reputation, you do not know me as a father. Like, so that's basically what that's the first thing you see. So that's why the whole show is called Testing the Name, because he thinks because of what he is, he's testing the name of his family. And the father's like, there's nothing to test. You're a part of our family always.
Oh my God. As your gay fan base just like soared. You must have so many gay followers. It's like, because Instagram is a big medium for you that you love to show people your process as an artist.
Yeah. I think it's important to share it, but I think Instagram now has sort of permutated into something that I don't know if it's necessarily beneficial now. I think when it started it was, but it's sad because I think a lot of people, they just look at you for what you can provide or what purpose you have and not the potential of what work can do and how that dialogue of exchange between artists and audience can be really fruitful in that medium. Mm-hmm. But right now it's just... You know, it's about a fantasy. It's about selling people what they want to see, like the glamorous life of art. Art is not glamorous. Art making is not glamorous. It's a rigorous practice.
Do you find it hard?
I mean, it's hard for a reason because you love it so much. Mm. Like, you wouldn't do something because it was easy. What is that thing that Janet Mock said in Dev's song where she's like, why would you want to do the least? Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's what I feel like Instagram has become. Like, why would you want to do the least? But that's what literally everyone is aiming for because they're scared. To be sincere or to be rigorous, and that saddens me. I don't know.
Well, hopefully your work will encourage people to, you know,
it is
do something and dream big.
It is doing. Hopefully it is. You're doing it. You're an inspiration.
I meant the new show. I mean,
London. And a new audience. A whole new audience are going to come to your work.
You know, it's not showing in New York. It's showing in London. So I imagine that will you by doing what you're doing are going to inspire people.
I hope so.
Yeah.
The show is traveling. Actually, it's going to be in London. Then it's going to Denmark.
Denmark, right, yeah.
And then it's going to the Hirshhorn.
Really?
Yeah, it's insane. I'm actually like, if I think about it really hard, I'd be scared. I'll get shook.
Going back to music, I wanted to let you know something, because I heard that your favorite karaoke song is Tyrone by Erykah Badu.
I mean, it's a classic.
And I love that. Oh my God.
Would you give us Erykah a bit Badu. Of Tyrone now?
Oh, I can't.
I bet you can.
But how important is music to you? Apart from this soundtrack that's been done for your show, do you listen to music in the studio?
All the time. I mean, it oscillates between like electronic, like, or Afrobeat, or like oldies but goodies kind of stuff, or like audiobooks. There's always something in the background. But I love music. I love especially music that transports you. So I tend to like very electronic kind of, basically what Peter's creating for this show. This kind of like African, hypnotic, transcending music that gets you lost.
Like then, low beats.
Yeah,
like,
just very kind of like subtle, and it's almost like it eases pulsing. Into you.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that kind of stuff.
So we ask every guest who comes on Talk Art two very important questions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which you'll know because you've listened
you
to Talk
You look really
Art.
Worried then. Like, you're like, what? Oh, okay.
I know, yeah. So the first one is, if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork that you like, we will help you. We can bring vans, cranes, anything you need. And or if you can't do that, it could be a touchstone, something that you always return to.
Oh, man.
What would it be?
There was something I saw. I really love Japanese woodblock prints. And please bear with me.
No,
it's on my phone. But
yeah.
I think
okay, you want to work in Japan, right? You want to show
I
there?
I really do. I love Japanese art. I've always been obsessed.
Because of mangas.
With...
Did manga get you into it?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like anime. But oh, yeah, Utamaro. And I know I'm probably butchering his name, but it's like Lovers in the Upstairs Tea Room.
Where did you see it?
It's. I remember seeing this. Like, such a beautiful piece. But if you zoom in, I don't know if I can get it with the screen. You see his eyes? Do you see that? It's like the such a subtle... I don't know if you can sell with the screen grab, but it's just like... I love this thing, like a story within a story images. And these prints were ubiquitous in Japan, you know, and how like everyone could buy them, right? Like they were like the equivalent of comics that people would just get, like the newspaper or something. And so this idea that these shunga, which are very kind of like erotic pieces, but this is so subtle and it's not explicit at all, and yet it's this intimate moment.
But the lines on this I can see in your work.
Yeah, I'm hugely inspired by this
1788 circa. Like, they don't know exactly when it is. That's amazing.
Because they made so many of them, and like some of them are really old and some of them are not. I've always wanted to do
something. And you saw that in the British Museum?
I think it was either in the museum or I saw it in a catalog, and I just remember being completely like in
awe.
You
can see this line in
her
new work.
Totally,
it's incredible. I remember I was in Japan last year in April, and I saw a Hokusai show with the Great Wave, and it was incredible seeing that. I mean, you know, of course we look at these prints and they're so small, but there's a world in these, like, you know, and the detail in them. Oh man, I could get lost in like Japanese printmaking. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
Are they quite valuable pieces then within like Japanese culture if you were to buy them?
Exactly. Right. Like first editions or whatever. But so that for the art heist, that would be my...
Amazing.
That would be
we can help you. That's the British Museum.
Yeah. We can certainly get you a postcard. The other question we ask is, what is your favorite color, Toying?
I would have to say the viscous black pen ink that I always use, because it's not black all the way. It's like a copper tone when the light hits it. So it's black that contains darkness and light at the same time. And so I've always, I mean, pen and ink is what started my career.
Like Biro, right? Yeah.
So,
and it also changes as it sinks into the page. No?
Exactly.
And so that's mercurial in its own way.
Yeah, it impresses onto the surface and it creates this sheen when light hits it. So I love this idea that something that could be equal parts or simultaneously really, really dark and really, really light at the same time. Yeah.
Wow.
I went deep.
Oh my God.
What's the word for that? Isn't there a word for that? Chiaroscuro.
I don't know. I just noticed black pen ink, you know, okay, but it's pen ink.
No, but I mean light and dark.
Oh.
Is it the work Chiaroscuro? There was a song by Paula Cole, who was an American singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
Who did like Where Have the Cowboys Gone?
Oh my God, that song.
She wrote a song called Chiaroscuro. And I remember looking up the word, and I think it means light and dark at one time or something.
That's actually perfect. And yeah. That song, Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, is a bop.
I know, I loved her. And she did that song about like...
But then I Don't Want to Wait is like dead to me. Like, no, I'm no, sorry, oh, yeah, Dawson's Creek.
No, but the song. Album before that, she
oh,
had
yeah.
a song.
I Don't Want to Wait, but it's like to be older.
Oh my God, here we go. Sing
yeah.
No, but there's another song she did that was like about a guy that she loves and he has a new girlfriend and he's left her behind and he's on a motorbike or something. That song used to make me cry.
It's really some intense like late 90s.
Seriously.
I'm thinking of Dawson's Creek. Have you been watching Pose?
Listen.
Dawson is in it. Dawson's in it playing a complete bastard. Yes. I hate Dawson now.
But then that's the thing I love about like all of these characters now that we've known. Like Pose is such an amazing show.
Amazing. I sob every single episode. I am sobbing my heart out. Billy Porter is a god. Everybody
and Janet
in that
Mock
is a
directing
god.
Directing and writing. I mean, just it's such a it's such an important.
India Moore, god, goddess, yes, just yes. like obsessed and
they are
so important.
And everyone there. And the fact that they are really calling attention to stories that, like, you know, like what I do, just something that shows the humanity of people and the layers of that humanity. It's so important for people to see now, definitely.
Well, talking about humanity, my teenage crush was Pacey. Out of Dawson's Creek.
Joshua Jackson.
I've just revealed that to the world.
Wow.
And along with Joaquin Phoenix.
Whoa.
They were my two guys. They were my guys.
Snap.
Two good choices.
See, mine was Keanu, man.
Really? See,
honey.
Everyone used to love him. Yeah.
Still. Yeah, we still love him.
No,
come on.
We were kids. I remember everyone going on about him, and I never really got it. I don't think I was old enough yet to quite understand what everyone was talking about.
I quite like Bruce Willis. Yeah.
Bruce
really?
Willis.
I know. In Die Hard, in the white vest, like running around. Oh, I loved it.
Oh my God, that totally sums up Russell
Crowe. He was bomb in Fifth Element, so I could see it. I could see it.
So, thank you so much for coming on Talk Art.
Thank you.
From the bottom of my heart, we are like so grateful
yeah,
that you.
God, this has been an amazing gift.
When you have this incredible like show about to be finished, and you came to meet us.
No, I'm honored. Thank you.
We wish you all the luck in the world for that, and we love you dearly, and think you're the shit.
Thank you.
You're the real deal.
Thank
and it's
you.
Brilliant to have you here.
So for everyone listening, we're going to be posting images of every artwork we've been discussing in this episode on our Instagram at Talk Art. And you can visit Toyin's Instagram and please follow, which is at
Toyin OG Odutola.
All one word. And we'll be back very soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.